Hi folks, just before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with our guest Shalika Kurup, all about the world's worst door. Yes, you heard right, world's worst door. A quick shout out and welcome to our latest Patreon donor. Hello to Keaton Ellis, who has become a £3 a month donor on Patreon, and as such will be entitled to access all of the bonus extra content we've been posting up on there. For those of you who are not Patreon donors, Ben and I are doing a monthly challenge every month of this year for our Patreon donors, where we set each other a weird and arcane task. Very much definitely not ripping off Taskmaster. Last month's involved us writing poems, running it through several different languages on Google Translate, and seeing what emerged. Keaton, welcome to the team, and you'll be getting to access all of that nonsense. Money well spent, I say. If anyone else wants to do as Keaton did, well, visit patreon.com/worstfootforward and sign up there to donate a few quid a month, or a yearly donation if you like, and help us keep making the podcast. Ben and I have nearly finished our drafts of a couple of chapters and an intro for the Worst Foot Forward book that we've been working on. We're putting the final finishing touches to that, and then we're going to send it to some people to have a little read, give us any last minute advice and tips. And then we're hopefully going to send it to some publishers and literary agents and things like that. Ooh, how terrifying. So that's something to hopefully look forward to over the course of the next while. God help us if someone says they actually want to publish it, then we'll have to write the rest of it. As ever, you can help support the podcast in other ways. You can give us a shout out on Twitter, on @worstfoot. You can find us on Facebook. Thanks to the people who've been messaging us there this week. A lot of messages have been popping in through Facebook particularly, and drop us an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you want to get in touch at length. You can also find Ben and I individually. Ben is on @BenVandeveld, I'm on @BasMaxStay, and do check out Ben's comedy club at Good Ship Comedy. They are about to rise like a phoenix from the lockdown ashes with some banging first shows back with some excellent headliners, and so go follow Good Ship Comedy and find out about their upcoming gigs as well. That'll do for this week, I think. It's nice and sunny outside. I'm going to go for a walk, and you're going to go listen to this week's episode. Just step through this door.
Welcome, friends, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vandeveld, and to quote the famous song, you know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I were to say to you that Jim Morrison was anything other than an overrated, uninspired, insipid waste of space in the rock pantheon who isn't even fit to brush Elvis's suede shoes or polish Dylan's spare pair of sunglasses. He's the two-dimensional, boorish frontman of a tedious, noodly group of enormously overrated musicians who distill everything that is bad about psychedelia into one easy-to-manage, drug-fueled car crash. And watching them now is as tedious and embarrassing as watching Al Jolson. The fact that he shares a space in the infamous Père Lachaise Cemetery with Oscar Wilde is nothing short of scandalous, since his grave is about as worthy of pilgrimage as a local chicken shop. Oh, felt good to get that off my chest. And in saying all that, the intro to Light My Fire is all right, but it's not exactly enough to build classic status around, is it? And still, somehow here, after a rant more self-involved than its own target, swinging, revolving, and sliding into your ears is Barry McStay.
And that is the end of our show.
You say that after too many of my ranty introductions.
Do you think maybe the problem isn't me, though, if I keep saying it? The problem is Jim Morrison.
The problem is regularly Jim Morrison. He's terrible in every way. He nicknamed himself the King Lizard. Ugh, red flags everywhere.
That's David Icke's job.
It is. Sorry, our guest has already got a point of order.
It was the Lizard King, and I'm a huge Doors fan.
And that concludes the podcast.
That concludes the podcast.
Not anymore, don't worry. I was convinced I'd marry Jim Morrison, despite him being dead for many years when I was 15. So.
Wow, yeah. That's a whole... Listen, let's get straight into introducing you, and then we can plumb that Freudian depth a little bit further. Our guest this week is a comedian, researcher and user experience designer. Her PhD investigated the user experience of rail passengers and the successful design and delivery of disruption information, with Britain's rail network being the perfect test subject for all of this. She's conducted analysis on accessibility and transportation requirements and now works for a major international technology solutions company, which provides everything from in-flight movie systems to cybersecurity for online banking and online transport ticketing. But alongside being a massive nerd, she also does cool stuff, like stand-up comedy. She has appeared at the likes of the Nottingham Comedy Festival, friend of the show Steve Cross's Science Show-Off shows, and at Ben's very own Good Ship Comedy. She's also presented a comedy night called Say My Name, a night all about mistaken and mispronounced names. So wish me good luck as I attempt to say, please welcome Shalika Kurup.
Hiya, nice to be here.
Nice to have you. Now, tell us what the wedding to Jim was like.
Well, it began when I was one of those really snotty teenagers who was like, I actually listen to actual music, not your pop music. I actually listen to classic rock.
I mean, I was one of those teenagers as well, but I didn't make the fatal error that you did.
So I got really, really, really into the Doors. I used to have a poster of a shirtless Jim Morrison on my bedroom door.
Listen, he had a solid thorax. I'll give him that. But can humans have thoraxes? I know insects can. Midsection. Body.
Torso, yeah.
Torso, that's the word I was after.
Yeah, I was painfully obsessed with him. It was embarrassing. And luckily, I wasn't allowed to get a tattoo when I still lived in my parents' house, which is good because I wanted a Jim Morrison tattoo. And thank Christ, I was never allowed to get one. So thank you to my parents.
A tattoo of his face or his whole body or?
No. I was much more pretentious than that. I wanted a tattoo of a quote from one of his interviews.
Oh, from an interview. Imagine.
Yep, it was something, I can't remember what it was anymore, but it was something that I found deeply profound and insightful and thought was going to be super cool. I wanted a tattoo over my, over here, over my heart.
Oh boy, Shalika, do I have a tinfoil full of catnip and OXO cubes to sell you under false pretenses? Wow. I mean, I think he is, because, and this is a theme I could really warm to over a number of hours, I think he's like the pitch-perfect bohemian himbo. Yep. Like, there's nothing going on there. He's absolutely vacant.
Yeah. He convinced a lot of people that he was, like, a deep, insightful poet. All of them did, right? Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, they were all...
Yeah, I don't know what he was like as a person. I mean, like, Jack Kerouac, absolute bellwiff. Like, horribly misogynistic piece of shit. And on, yeah. Like, and that's, there's something that's worse than the Doors. On the Road, a terrible... terrible excuse for a novel. Ginsberg, obviously, as a opinionated top hat wearing bad Jew, I've got a lot of time for personally. I don't know what he was like as a human, but Howl, absolutely banging piece of work.
Yeah, no, Jack Kerouac was one of those people that I'm ashamed that I've read any of his work more than one time.
But I mean, I'd like to hope that the reason you went back is like, I've just got to check. I've just got to check that he is as bad as I think he is and everyone else is wrong. Because to be fair to you, I did listen to the Doors album twice, just to check. And on the second reason, I was not only did I know that I was right, but I was angry at myself for listening at it the first time.
Can I just say though, maybe they would have been great if they hadn't all been hepped up on LSD. Maybe the thing is, they are actually like, they go, oh, LSD has unlocked all of these creative juices. And actually, LSD made them terrible. Imagine what Jack Kerouac and Jim Morrison would have written if they weren't on LSD.
See, I think the Doors would have been better without all of the drugs. But Jack Kerouac, I think he needed all the help he could get.
Yeah.
Worst foot forward here, single-handedly tearing apart the 20th century canon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen, playing any musical instrument on LSD is impressive because it's got to be pretty good playing a guitar when you think you're holding a live trout.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Shalika, you're obviously very good at getting over teenage infatuations. What would you say you are worst at in the world?
Oh, I actually spent a lot of time thinking thinking about this because somehow deep inside my head, I think I'm just a narcissist. Where I was like, there's nothing I'm that bad at. And then I thought and thought and thought, and I was like, there is, and it's whistling. I cannot whistle at all.
Oh, you're just like my wife. My wife cannot do it. Like, no, there's no way of saying this sentence without coming off like quite the Jim Morrison, but I'm quite a good whistler. That's also quite a Partridge thing to say, but I'm going to get myself out of this. I'm not as good a whistler as Barry's husband.
My husband is a very good whistler.
Really?
And that is not a euphemism. Genuinely, he has, I think he has put it on his acting CV, on his spotlight page, saying like whistling as an extra skill.
I'm so jealous. I can't do it.
How do you, you know, perv on sexy men when they walk past, or hail a cab in the 1950s if you can't whistle?
Hey you. It worked. I'm currently living with a vaguely sexy man, so.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say you're living with a vaguely sexy taxi driver.
That would be ideal, but we can't have everything.
No, we absolutely can't. And to be fair, well done you for going for your backup career in academia, because I think we all know that what you really wanted to be was a shepherd. Yep. But just couldn't do it. Couldn't do it.
You'd probably get a good solid 5 minutes out of it on stage if you really wanted to.
Just whistle? Yeah.
Just trying it.
It's a comedy set waiting to happen. Yeah. Somebody tried to skip several steps and teach me how to whistle like this, and that was...
Oh, with the fingers in the mouth.
Nothing.
I don't think that works. That doesn't work for me. I can whistle just by pursing my lips, but I don't get how the fingers in the mouth are meant to help.
Listeners, if you're listeners, if you're listening to this, you should be, because that by definition makes you a listener. If you're the sort of person who can whistle by sticking their fingers in your mouth, please tell us how you learned, how you do it, and
send us a short video on Twitter to @worstfoot.
There you go.
Why don't we ask? This is the point of the show. God, Ben, we've been doing this for over 200 episodes, and we never at the start of an episode go, remind people to give us money on Patreon as often as we do. Send us weird shit on Twitter.
Yeah, that's much more likely to be successful.
Whistling don't pay the mortgage, Ben.
This week, our suggestion for our topic came from Shalaka herself, and it's about the world's worst door. And Barry, you're going to be the first person to stand on the pressure sensitive mat and await the doors to open.
First of all, I read about Janus, the Roman animistic spirit of doorways and archways. How many faces does Janus have?
Two.
QI klaxon sound. Janus is usually represented with two faces, but occasionally he'd be represented as four-faced, because in ancient Rome they sometimes had four-faced, four-way arches. Right. And so Janus could represent those as well. So he sometimes had four faces. And apparently the worship of Janus is really old. It dates back to Romulus and before the actual foundation of Rome itself. And Janai, ceremonial gateways in Rome, were very common. There were freestanding structures used for like parades during religious festivals, or if armies were marching off to war, sometimes they would have to march through a lucky archway. And apparently there were lucky and unlucky ways of doing it and so on. And the Janus Geminus was in Rome. It was a shrine to Janus on the north side of the Forum. And it was a rectangular bronze structure with double doors at each end. Apparently, they would leave those doors open during times of war and would close them when Rome was at peace. And according to Livy, the gates were only ever closed twice in the period between the 7th and the 1st century BC. Because Rome be busy at that time. Rome be warring. I just googled doors in general, and there's like, it's obvious, but that like doors began at a certain point. But it goes, doors really began during the ancient Egyptians' time, was the general consensus of what I found on the internet. Because beforehand, if you were living in a hut or something, you just have an animal skin hung over the doorway. But actual hinged doors originate mainly in ancient Egypt, apparently. But I read about one particular Egyptian, the mathematician Heron of Alexandria, in the 1st century AD. He invented the first known automatic door.
What?
Yeah, he used heat from a fire lit by the temple priest, and after a few hours the atmospheric pressure would build up in this vessel and would pump some water into other containers, a bit like pistons, and they'd act as weights. that would open the doors temple at exactly the time people would arrive for prayer. So it wasn't activated by people arriving. They would just have it on it. If they lit the fire at a certain time, the pressure would build up so that at the moment people were arriving to pray in the temple, the doors would open.
That sounds a little bit, and I don't know if it's this particular one, but in the Terry Pratchett book Small Gods, there are doors that are apparently opened by the breath of God. And the big reveal in it is obviously it's not the breath of God, it's a series of weights and pulleys and water pressure in a chamber. And there's, and I think in a number of ancient temples, that notion carried on, that there were things that were supposedly miraculous, but actually you just had the nerds behind the scenes doing making the miracle happen.
Yeah, absolutely. More modern, in 1931, engineers Horace H. Raymond and Sheldon S. Robey of Stanley Works in America, they designed the first optical device that triggered an automatic door being opened at Wilcox's Pier restaurant in West Haven, Connecticut. And it was born of necessity. Waiters carrying heavy plates of food and drink, they needed a door that would open for them. And they sold this whole system for $100, so relatively cheap given what they had created. And then the first sliding automatic door, D. Horton and Lew Hewitt invented in 1954. They noticed that when winds were quite high around the campus at Corpus Christi College, that it was difficult to get doors open, or they would swing open. And so they tried to come up with a solution that would counteract the high winds. And so they came up with, you mentioned earlier, a mat, a pressure plate that would open the sliding door. And they founded Horton Automatics Incorporated in 1960. I basically just looked up all my favourite doors. And the revolving door, it's a comedy favourite. In December 1881, H. Bochacker of Berlin was granted a German patent for a door without draft of air, or Tür ohne Luftzug.
Like all things, it sounds so much more terrifying in German.
Yeah, the Tür ohne Luftzug mightn't have caught on as much as the revolving door.
Yeah, my son got obsessed with lawnmowers during this first lockdown, and so we watched a lot of lawnmowers on YouTube, including one German lawnmower advert that went on and on and on. And lawnmower sounds kind of delightful in English and German. It's die Rausenmauer.
The Rausenmauer is coming to get you.
Precisely.
Are there lots of lawnmowers on YouTube?
You'd be surprised. There's lots of everything on YouTube, but I think that this particular Rausenmauer was one of the ones that you sit in and you drive like a Dodgem.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, interesting.
But I know there's a big YouTube trend for videos of people shredding things. Like industrial shredders of people like shredding like massive like hunks of metal or toys or all sorts of things.
Yeah, no, it's not like a direct live feed of the British Commonwealth Office going, there's a lot of documents from the 50s and 60s, get rid.
Then Theophilus Van Cannell of Philadelphia, he was granted a US patent in 1888 for a storm door structure, he called it. It's the more traditional three-partition revolving door that we'd imagine. And he stated in the patent that the door possesses numerous advantages over a hinged door structure. It is perfectly noiseless, effectually prevents the entrance of wind, snow, rain, or dust. Moreover, the door cannot be blown open by the wind. There is no possibility of collision, and yet persons can pass both in and out at the same time. There is an urban myth, apparently, that Van Cannell basically had a phobia of opening doors for others, particularly of women. This is incorrect, according to our friends at Snopes, but that is quite a common myth on the internet. He was awarded the John Scott Legacy Medal in 1889 for his contribution. In 1889, the first wooden revolving door was installed at Rector's, a restaurant in Times Square. And in 2007, Van Cannell was inducted into National Inventors Hall of Fame.
I want to repick my worst door pick now, because I think about revolving doors and I hate them.
I will let you explain with all of your qualifications why they are not good. I'll talk about one more favourite door of mine before I get to terrible ones. I love saloon doors. There was a restaurant that we used to go to when we went on holidays in Portugal, my family and I, where the entrance to the bathroom had saloon doors, which, according to the definition I found online, they have two characteristics. They do not extend all the way to the floor nor to the top of the door jamb, but block the doorway at roughly torso height, and they feature bi-directional hinges. My younger brother would go to the toilet an unreasonable amount of times during nights out at that restaurant. It's purely so he could John Wayne his way through these.
It's not a proper set of saloon doors unless, as you come in, there's a spittoon like 7 to 10 foot away.
Yeah,
and I imagine someone else there with a tiny triangle for every time that you spit in it. Ding!
The thing I found most interesting was I found an article where someone was speculating as to why they had these doors. Because at night, saloons had another set of outer shutter doors. These weren't the only doors on the saloons. So why these particular saloon-style doors? What was the point of them? Number one, the suggestion was to get passing trade. You can have, like, the sounds of the bar wafting out into the street. But rather than just leaving the door fully open, obviously bars were also places where people were drinking heavily and gambling and hiring prostitutes. So having some level of modesty provided by the doors helped to cover those up while still letting the sound bleed lure potential customers in, is one suggestion. The other suggestion is, well, the bidirectional hinges allow people carrying crates of bottles of beer in and out to pass through without having to open the door, much like the automatic doors for the waiters in the restaurant I mentioned earlier. This article I read suggested that I believe these were an early stab at UX, user experience. I've gone to London for some terrible doors. There's a door in Westminster Abbey next to the Chapter House, which has a sign beside it saying it is the oldest door in England. And there's a story attached to it which says that in 1303 there was a robbery in Westminster Abbey, and apparently it was an inside job by the monks. And Edward.
That's a great sentence to be able to say.
It's a Robbie Coltrane and Eric Idle movie waiting to happen. And Edward III apparently flayed the guilty men and used their skin to cover this doorway.
Oh.
Now the door was tested. It underwent dendrochronological or tree age testing. And the door itself dates from 1043, and there are traces of skin on it. Animal hide, you'll be grateful to know. I read about Sebastian Horsley, who you may have heard, is the English artist and writer, a famous libertine and Soho resident. He once went to the Philippines to be crucified as an artistic experiment.
Okay.
And he wrote a lot of stuff about having drug addictions and his reliance on prostitutes and things like that. But he lived on Meard Street, which is a small alleyway in Soho, at 7 Meard Street, and a sign on the door to his house once read, "This is not a brothel, there are no prostitutes at this address." Because apparently a lot of doorways on the street were being used by scammers to try and, you know, extract money from people by pretending there would be prostitutes or a brothel behind the door so long as people paid them, leading to lots of angry confrontations. It may also have been Sebastian Horsley going, no, you definitely don't want to knock on my door, police constable. I definitely don't have any prostitutes here.
That sounds like a guilty person if I ever heard one.
Yeah, protesting way too much by advertising it on his doorway.
Yep.
But I am going to put forward the door to number 10 Downing Street as the world's worst door. We talked about it briefly when we did our walking tour of London live stream earlier last year. First of all, there is a fake Downing Street door. 10 Adam Street, which is just off the Strand, is a row of neoclassical terraced houses there known as Adelphi, built around the same time as Downing Street. So the style is very similar. And the number 10 there has a very similar black door and similar rose window above it. So you'll often get tourists posing outside what is in fact just an office building, pretending they're standing outside the door to 10 Downing Street.
Oh, I misunderstood. So I thought you meant there's the actual 10 Downing Street, which is a secret and no one knows where it is.
Oh,
and
yeah.
All the press conferences are in front of the door somewhere. That's amazing.
Shalaka, you've blown this thing wide open.
Well, mate, that's what the IRA tried to do in 1991, isn't it?
more on that in a second, yes. But number 10, I've a number of reasons I don't like number 10 Downing Street store. For number
firstly,
one...
Firstly, because you're not a citizen of this country and you're unwilling to assimilate.
All right, Jacob Rees-Mogg, calm down. Firstly, it's a lie. Number 10 is not number 10, or certainly wasn't number 10 originally. It was originally number 5 Downing Street. The building that's number 10, I think, has... Actually, 4 or 5 of the buildings have sort of been subsumed into what is now number 10. They were renumbered in the 1770s. The door itself is famously black, but Herbert Asquith, when he was Prime Minister, he had it repainted a dark green.
Oh, I quite like that.
Yeah, it looked quite nice. I love this job title. Historical paint consultant Patrick Beatty suggested that Brunswick green or bronze green was actually fairly common on doorways during the early part of the 19th century. And black on external surfaces was actually quite rare until the 1930s, 1940s onwards.
Interesting.
Also, the building itself is now painted black, probably because the building was just getting really dirty. They've just gone, well, let's lean into it. It was renovated in 1960. And repainted black with the white numbers on it. The zero is not straight. if you look at number 10 Downing Street, the zero and the what, there's a one and a zero for number 10. The zero is actually at a 37 degree angle. Some people suggest the original zero was a bit wonky, so when they put the new one on, they just were aping that. Whereas actually, if you look at it, it's not a zero, it's an O.
Oh, I've just seen it. It's so upsetting.
Yeah, it's really upsetting. And it's not, because it's, you've got a number and a letter beside each other, your eye just looks, it sort of jars.
Oh.
And it's probably a cost-saving device. The Ministry of Works were using a font called Trajan, Roman Trajan, at the time, and they just would have had a convenient O lying around, whereas number, for whatever reason, they didn't have so many numbers, so they would just have stuck this O on instead. Ben mentioned in 1991 the IRA targeted Downing Street in a mortar attack, and the original oak door was replaced by a steel blast-proof one. The original door has been moved to the Churchill Museum. It is maintained by an official cleaner from number 10 Downing Street. Ugh. And the new door, the blast-proof one, was reinforced and made to look identical to its predecessor, because nothing must change in this country. Everything must always look the same. Not only that, the door that you see on number 10 Downing Street is only that door for 6 months of the year.
What?
What?
They alternate doors. They repaint them every 6 to 12 months, and so they take one of these doors off and put the spare steel door on.
Okay, so obviously the most important question here is, where is the spare number 10 Downing Street door kept?
It's probably at number 10 Adam Street. It's the fake one I mentioned earlier.
I feel like, you know how in the same way that Saddam Hussein and Colonel Gaddafi had lots of
doubles
of themselves, I think this country is so addicted to its own heritage that somewhere there's a giant warehouse with spare Nelson's columns and spare marble arches. I've got a complete I've got a complete blank of like major statuary in this country. Probably what it really is an enormous warehouse full of row upon row of 18th century slave owners that they're just ready to pop back up on a plinth when one gets knocked down.
Like in Raiders of the Lost Ark at the end, we've got top slavers. Top slavers. Also, the door is not a really good functioning door. It can't be opened from the outside, despite the fact that the doorbell has the sign PUSH inscribed on it. It is operated solely by a security guard inside it who has a video camera, and they have to open the door to let anyone in. It has a letterbox, a letter plate on it, that's purely decorative, and it has a lock on it, which is filled in. All of the aspects that make it, like, a door don't operate, apart from the fact someone has to open it and let you in and out, and yet it's sort of this symbol of British power. And the biggest thing that I hate about it is that every Prime Minister of this country since 1997 has actually lived at number 11 Downing Street anyway, because the apartment in there is bigger.
Yeah, and also, let's be fair, my biggest problem with it is that you open it and go inside and it's where Boris Johnson lives, which I think we can all agree. And I mean, fill in literally any Prime Minister of the past 75 years other than Clement Attlee.
Yeah.
Shalaka, I feel like you're going to be more design-based rather than history-based, but I may be wrong. But either way, what are you bringing to the table?
So, I was trying to think of different types of doors, or like 10 Downing Street, different doors that I've seen in my lifetime. But I thought it would actually be more interesting to talk about a specific type of door, mm-hmm. as opposed to revolving doors, for example. So the door that I wanted to talk about is called the Norman Door. Now, the Norman Door is named after this ergonomist and psychologist called Don Norman, who wrote one of the best books on design that there is. It's basically the Design Bible, which is the psychology of everyday things.
That's a lovely title. I also have to, I didn't realize it was named after a person. I thought the Norman Door was just the one that William the Conqueror opened in 1066. It was like, this way, lads, we're in Westminster Abbey already.
Yeah, it's named after Don Norman. And I discovered only recently that he's actually perfectly fine with it, but why it was both, it's the worst type of door, but also my favorite door, because I found it incredibly funny that he identified this huge problem with how people design doors, and then they just named this horrible door after him. And he's like, this is, so basically what a Norman door is, it's a door that's designed in a way that's opposite to intuitive movement. So it's basically designed in a way that doesn't match what you're supposed to do with it. It doesn't suggest the right movement you're supposed to use with it. So the best example for it is a pull sign on a push door or a push sign on a pull door. That's what a Norman door is.
Right.
And he pointed out that this was a huge issue, and they were like, oh, well, it's named after you now. So he's apparently fine with it, but it is the worst design of door. And what I found really funny and why I like this Don Norman guy so much is all of the things that I first noticed when I moved to his country are all bits of evidence in his book for bad piece of design. So one of my favorite classic ones is the push sign on the pull door. But he talks about taps in this country, which taps in this country are psychotic. I have no clue why you have separate hot and cold water taps.
Yeah.
I've lived here for 7 years and I still haven't got hold of it. I have no clue why this is a thing.
The Norman taps. Yeah, they're a well-established Norman Fawcett.
Yeah, pretty much.
Norman Fawcett, I think, was an opening batsman for England in the 1940s.
Yeah, almost certainly.
Yeah.
That is very true.
What's the alternative? What are we doing wrong that they were doing?
A mixer tap, all-in-one.
Literally, the ones where you push to one side and it's hot, and then you push to the middle and it's warm, and you push to the other side and you could freeze your hands off. That's the right type of tap.
Ben looks absolutely like his mind is blown. Ben, please, of all the things that you think this country should cling on to, and you are not a traditionalist in any shape or form, I can see behind your eyes, you're like, but I like the separate taps.
I kind of do.
No, Ben!
You shouldn't have
spit that Kool-Aid out.
You shouldn't have to pick which your favorite hand is every time you wash your hands.
Or do that stupid thing where you're dabbing one hand between the two streams.
Like that way. Oh, wait, this is a podcast.
Yeah, audio medium.
Yeah. No, but I like... So, listen, the reason why I like it is so our bath and our bathroom has the two separate taps that you have to... And I feel like every time I run a bath for my children, I feel like I'm trying to crack a safe. Mm. And I kind of enjoy that, having to twiddle a hot tap, twiddle a cold tap to get it right. The both of you look utterly disgusted.
Yep.
I mean, really not happy.
This is like, I don't know, my parents or something, where they're like, oh no, you should do this long, complicated method of cooking this food because it's better. And I'm like, is it though? Is this long, complicated method better? Or are you just stuck to nostalgia?
I've read a little bit about Don Norman. He has two sort of principles he talks about: discoverability and feedback.
Yeah.
Can you explain what those are?
Yeah, sure. They are exactly what they sound like. So discoverability is kind of when you have something presented to you, it's easily understood what you're supposed to do with it. So for example, if you have a mug with a handle, intuitively the object suggests to you that maybe you should use this handly bit to pick it up. That's what discoverability is. And then feedback is literally the object or the system or whatever giving you feedback. So if you excellent feedback is any sort of button, you know, when something is a button, because when you click it kind of goes in indents a little bit and then comes back out. That's what feedback is.
So that was a thing on smartphones when they were developing them. How to like replicate the sense of pushing a button when you were just tapping a screen.
Yeah, that's why they have the tap noise, which, as we got more and more evolved and used to smartphones, they just kind of removed it because people didn't need that sort of comfort anymore.
But they still animate this, like on a keyboard on a smartphone, still is the like visual image of it being depressed and released.
Yeah. I wonder what part of our evolution that is. Maybe it's that we've evolved along with the technology, but that being the apes that we are, we like the push down and in experience, because a button is not a naturally occurring thing. You don't find bubble wrap in nature.
Yeah, it's basically a case of needing that sort of response to make you feel like something has happened in that situation. So one of my favorite examples of a button is, I mean, this has more of a purpose, I'm just oversimplifying it, but in New York, all of the crosswalks, well, a lot of the crosswalks, you know, when you click the button and the little red man turns to a green man, none of that works in a lot of roads in New York. They completely don't work. The entire traffic system is controlled by someone sitting in an operation center somewhere. They only have it because of human error. Because if you told people it wouldn't work, people wouldn't even stop to press the button and wait or pay attention to the man. So you're basically creating that extra step to save humans from themselves, essentially.
Yeah. You're giving us the illusion of control.
Essentially, yeah. It's the same thing in elevator doors in the United States, where because of the Americans with Disability Act, you can't press the close button. I mean, you can, but it just doesn't work. because people should be reasonably allowed to get onto an elevator, especially if they move at a slower pace than other people. So those buttons don't really work. They're just giving people an illusion of control, essentially, in that situation.
So the sort of discoverability you get with a lot of Norman doors then is, the example I'm thinking of is you get these office buildings which have like glass doors with the long metal strips in the the double doors, long metal strip hanging down in the middle, which look like handles.
Yeah.
And handles, to me, always suggest pull.
Yeah.
But so, these doors will be a push door.
Yeah. So his design, this is what I love about a lot of design, is it's just easy. His solution is just, if it's a push door, he says fire exit doors are the best one. But if it's a push door, you just have nothing on it, just a flat surface. So you just kind of can just walk through it. And he actually says this, which is kind of almost poetic, where he's like, the best type of door is a door that doesn't make you realize that you walked through it. That is which
that's
I
amazing.
Find, but it's basically, that's why he loves fire doors, because he's like, you just kind of walk through it. You just kind of push it. You don't recognize what you're doing. You're not struggling. You completely not even register that you've been through a door because it's that good. And then the pull side obviously has a handle. So, yeah,
I think we talked about, we did World's Worst Theatre as an episode recently. We talked about crash doors being designed as in response to theatre fires. And they are like, because you want a door that makes you not realise you've gone through a door and that opens really easily and is easy to open no matter who you are. They are the epitome of that sort of practical design. I imagine that impractical design must infuriate you day to day then, given all your life is consumed by user experience.
Yep. One of the things that somebody said as a joke, which is now on my Twitter profile, is one time in my entire life, one time I picked up something stupid. I think it was actually a sauce from McDonald's that didn't open properly, like one of those dips. And I said, this is an ergonomic nightmare. And ever since then, my friend like teased me about saying that. So it's on my Twitter profile or something like
that. But it must be because, you know, this is partially working as a comedian / living as a human being. Mm-hmm. I regularly want to fall to my knees and despair to the heavens about the state of humanity and the average level of stupidity in the average human. But you get that with objects.
Yep.
Like at least the things that I get angry with are sentient.
Yep.
Just every moment you're just looking around at the way the entire world has been designed and you're like, we need to go back to draft one and start again.
Yeah, I have a 10-minute comedy set on how, a weird comedy set to have, but I have a 10-minute comedy set on how the worst design trousers, men's trousers for sex, are the ones that have just buttons and no zippers. And it just happened I started talking about it once at a comedy night and I just kept going and I was like, wow, I did not realize that this is a very deep-rooted issue in my heart.
Also, I think this is probably because you've looked at lots and lots of posters of Jim Morrison and every single one, it's buttons, not zippers. And you're like, come on, how am I meant to get into the prize?
Yeah.
all I'm saying is you're not helping your reputation as an amateur necromancer here.
Why do you hate revolving doors?
Oh, yes. Two things. Firstly, huge socially anxious person, I don't like being touched. So the number of times I've been in a revolving door where somebody gets in at the same section as me.
Yeah.
Just makes me feel sick to my stomach. And people will do this to you. People, especially in India, where there's tons of people trying to get through their revolving doors. People will come and stand right next to you and then have to just suffer in silence for the next 20 seconds.
While being chased by a sheet of glass.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't love it.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I can imagine it's the, you know, for a socially anxious person, it's the equivalent of being, of when a wasp suddenly flies into a room, but instead of a wasp, it's 10 other humans.
Yeah, I'm not bad with crowds, obviously being Indian. It's just, it's not about the number of people, it's the, someone being that close to me makes me want to feel physically sick.
Wow.
Yeah, there are times when my parents have hugged me where I've been like, okay, are we done now?
God, I imagine living in India and being either claustrophobic or agoraphobic must be a nightmare because you're just like, there's lots of people inside. There's even more people outside. I don't know where to go.
Yep, it was an interesting experience. I think I was fine mostly because it was just part of my life. And then I moved to the UK and I was like, oh my God, people hate talking to you or standing close to you or showing any affection. I love this country. I am
the pandemic must have been a blessing for you.
It was great. The first time somebody walked super close to me, I lost my mind. And I just went home. I was on the way to the shops and I was like, I'll go tomorrow. I just don't want to do this.
The other thing that gets me about the revolving doors, I read a story about, not funny, quite sad, 1942, a nightclub in Boston. There was a fire there and the doorway in and out was a single revolving door. Oh. So you'd nearly 500 people perish. And the next year, Massachusetts law was changed. You know, revolving door, that many people trying to squeeze through it, it's bound to get jammed. In 1943, Massachusetts state law changed to require a revolving door to have an outward swinging hinged door
next to it.
Yeah. Or to make the revolving door be collapsible. That's basically standard law now in most places around the world, I think. So revolving doors, they're like, oh, we've got these revolving doors. By the way, they're death traps. The proof is the fact there's actual doors beside them.
The worst door for you then must be a revolving door that is also a Norman door. So a revolving door that you go in and it looks like you have to push, but you actually have to pull and go round it backwards.
Just gonna say. The other reason, which is such a weird reason, and I'm pretty sure I'm the only Indian person that has this, so it's not anything about Indian people. Mm. But in Hindu mythology, there was this demon who was basically granted a wish. I might be telling the story wrong, but he was granted a wish by a god he wished to be invincible by anybody. So he said, I don't want to be killed by a man or woman, a human or an animal, in day or night, inside or outside. And he thought he'd covered all his bases. And then, long story short, he does a lot of evil things. Nobody can murder him. And then eventually, Vishnu, I think, comes down in like a half lion, half human form and rips him in half in the threshold of a door at twilight. And that's how they managed to vanquish this demon.
I love that Hindu mythology has got a classic haunted house trope in it.
Yep. But it's why it's like bad luck to stand in a threshold of a door. So even now when I do it, my mom tells me to either move forward or backwards a little bit. But that's why revolving doors make me feel like I'm very much in the threshold for a little bit too long.
Yeah. Oh, I like it. I love the thought of being able to approach a building with a revolving door and be like, I'm terribly sorry, that door is against my religion.
I'm not even religious. This is the kicker. It's just like, you know, when your parents give you these weird fears while growing up and then you're just like, oh, we'll just carry this forever in my...
Yeah. Yep, that's childhood. I think Philip Larkin had something to say on the matter.
He does. I've got a real problem with authority uniforms, shiny buttons and armbands. I don't know where they come from. And anytime I see a squashed spider, just poor, the old heartbeat starts going. We'll start in India, I think. So stand by for some tricky pronunciations from Team Vanderveld. Which part of India is your family from, Shalaka?
We're from Kerala, but I lived in Bangalore, which is in Karnataka, my whole life.
Being a pub quiz bore, I should have a good idea of where states are. Like, Kerala is coastal, is that right?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Sound, yeah. I mean, I only know that because I know Kerala curries are normally got seafood in and they are banging. There is a temple in a place called Trivandrum, and the temple is the temple of Sri Padmabaswamy. It is a holy shrine to Vishnu. It was built in the 16th century and it is the most gilded temple you have ever seen. If you can picture in your mind, listeners, a Hindu temple, a lot of them are covered in reliefs of incredible scenes from Hindu epics. And this one is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 stories high, covered in gold. And in it, there are 6 vaults. And in 2011, when 5 out of the 6 vaults were opened, it was brimful of gold, jewels, coins, idols, and the estimated value of the wealth in them was, and I'm going to try not to say this in a Dr. Evil voice, $1 trillion.
Whoa.
There was, however, a 6th door. And I will show you guys a picture of this door in a minute, but all I can say is it... If you were watching Indiana Jones and Indiana Jones came up to this door, as an audience member, you'd be thinking, don't open the door, Indy. Absolutely. Do not open this door. So here is the picture, my friends.
Whoa.
So just to describe it to you, It's a grey door. It's got two serpent dragons on either side and a monkey wolf demon head above it. And again, real bad vibes from that door. I think we can agree.
Whoa. There's snakes and tongues being stuck out. And it's Harry Potter meets Indiana Jones.
Yeah, absolutely. There is going to be some angry basilisks behind that door. Yeah. So you can just imagine you open it up and just a basilisk going, do you mind? Yes. I was having a lovely rest. Now, what I love about this door is that the legend has it that in the 1930s, some invaders tried to get into that vault but couldn't succeed because as they tried to open it, a bunch of cobras just appeared out of nowhere and did for them. There's another belief that it is protected by a fatal curse and that can only be opened by a Hindu priest who has the knowledge of the Garuda mantra. And apparently, there is not a priest alive who has knowledge of that, and therefore no priest can be trained to have the mantra to open this up. Since we have a real actual Hindu person on this podcast, albeit one who just gave me a look that said, I'm about as good a Hindu as you are a Jew, Ben, do you want to tell me how much of what I've just said might be bullshit?
To be honest, I've never heard this story before, and I went to the Hindu version of Bible study for many years, so go with me! I have heard of the Garuda mantra, though. Don't know it, which is why I also cannot open this door.
Yeah. Oh. Is this history's biggest Norman door? You require a mantra to open it, a mantra which nobody knows.
Also, what I was thinking of when you said that nobody could open this door is that this is the perfect setting for a classic white man discovers something dangerous in India story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's got real sort of Howard Carter vibes of, right, let's send a couple of natives to open it up, let's flush the curses out, and then I'll stride in with my cane and top hat to take the glory.
It belongs in a museum, preferably one several thousand miles away. Yeah.
Going to a different kind of mythology now, do you know in churches about devil's doors? So there are many churches, particularly ones built around the 11th, 12th, 13th century, where the most northerly door is either bricked up or so securely fastened and locked that you cannot get in or out of it. The notion is that at the time, that was a door that was for people who were pagan or had pagan practices in their families to go in. And that was a way of going either so the priest or vicar in charge of the church could go, watch out for them, they're the wrong uns. But to sort of separate out the communities. Another notion is that when a child was baptized, in order for the baptism to go well, the child had to cry, and the child crying, that would be the devil leaving their body. And the northernmost door was left open, and that was the door through which the devil escaped from the baptized child.
This makes a lot of sense to me because I think early compasses used Lucifer's tail to point north rather than magnets. I think, this all stacks up.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a particular tale, or a tale of Black Shuck in a place called Blytheborough. And Black Shuck is basically a Grimm from Harry Potter, since we just mentioned them, of a shaggy black dog, or perhaps a horse with fiery red eyes that was an omen of death, or indeed the devil. In Old English, skooka or skuk means both the words devil and terrify. And apparently, on August the 4th, 1577, during a Sunday service in Blytheborough, which is in Suffolk, lightning struck the church, dislodged the church spire, caused it to fall through the roof onto the gathered congregation. And amid the darkness and destruction, this shaggy black dog appeared and burst through a door and left long scorching claw marks along a door there. And those score marks are now known as the devil's fingerprints.
Cool.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe I'd have stayed in church more if stuff like that happened.
Yeah. And then reading about that took me on to reading about doors to hell and gateways to hell.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you know it's actually a highway to hell?
Yeah. Yeah. It's probably a toll booth to hell.
But yeah, all roads lead to Rome, but all highways lead to hell.
Yep.
Seems vaguely appropriate. We're recording this in the week that Meatloaf's collaborator Jim Steinman died, that we talk about ways to get in and out of hell.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, I can certainly tell you all of the ways to get into hell, my lifestyle. Lifestyle between the ages of 16 and 33 until my wife made me a better man. Do you know, my friends, in which country the door to hell can be found?
Is it in Italy?
No.
Norway? Sorry.
I should point out there are various doors to hell all around the world, according to mythology. But the most believable door to hell, shall we say, in terms of aesthetics?
There's one in, what do you call them? Did one? Oh. Rodin did a sculpture called The Gates of Hell or something.
No, it's not the one I'm thinking of.
Which I think is inspired by Divine Comedy. But I don't know where that is.
Certainly one of those.
Is it based on proximity?
Basically,
like, what's the lowest country? Like, is it the Netherlands? Because it's closer to hell. It's on the low sea level.
Whether it's something that has, like, the lowest in terms of actual location, or whether it's something in terms of, like, quality, like some country with tons of volcanoes.
Mm. We're on the vague, right, by the way. Well, I'll tell you on this one. If you were to travel to Turkmenistan, then you would find the Darvaza gas crater, which is known as the door to hell. Now, what happened is in 1971, Soviet geologists may have intentionally set it on fire to prevent the spread of methane gas. It backfired and an enormous crater blew up. And now there is this huge gash in the ground, and they completely underestimated how much natural gas is there, and it is going to burn for potentially decades, if not centuries.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
That's a really weird, mild name for something this horrific, because the word Darvaza literally means door.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yeah, it literally means door. So it's like, this giant methane burning crater. Let's just call it, I don't know, a door, maybe.
Oh, I don't know. Door is fine, but referring to something as the door certainly makes it maybe a little bit scarier.
I've just looked it up. It's like the incinerator at the end of Toy Story 3, but in the middle of a desert.
Yeah, it was basically, they thought it was going to be an oil site, because obviously that part of the world has got that. But instead, it's just it's in the middle of nowhere. And when you see the close-up pictures, it just sort of looks like these constant embers. But from afar, it really does look like a hell mouth. It's terrifying.
Amazing.
Wow.
Other places which may be entrances to the underworld, there is the river Acheron in northwest Greece, which is how Odysseus is meant to have travelled there. Orpheus travelled to the underworld by entering a cave, or Cape Teneron, which is the southern tip of the Peloponnese. There's also Mount Etna was believed to be one, and indeed another volcano called Hekla in Iceland, which is both one of the most active volcanoes and the one in which dead comedians are thrown into. And this description here by the monk Herbert de Clairvaux, who said the renowned fiery cauldron of Sicily, which men call Hell's Chimney, that cauldron is affirmed to be like a small furnace compared to this enormous inferno. Another monk called Benedict referred it to as the eternal prison of Judas. And I went down quite the gateway to hell rabbit hole. There is another one in China. There's a place called Fengdu Ghost City, which sort of looks like a Taoist version of Port Merion, is the best way I can describe it. Like, Port Merion, for those that don't know, is essentially an enormous folly that was built in the 19th century on the western coast of Wales, and someone built like a Italian Tuscan village in the middle of Wales for reasons of Victorian eccentricity. The site's history goes back nearly 2,000 years, and according to legend, it's got its name as a ghost city because two imperial officials, Yin Changshen and Wang Fangping, came to this place to practice Taoism. And the combination of their names, Ying and Wang, means literally King of Hell.
Huh.
And so there are three stages that you have to go through to pass whether you do or do not end up in hell. First, they must pass the Bridge of Helplessness. And there are three archers on this bridge, and the middle one is used for testing people as to whether they will get through based on various protocols. Then there is another place called the Ghost Torturing Pass, which is the second test. Your ethereal form goes through various torture trials to see whether you can get through into the happy part of the afterlife or not, the good place or not. And then the third one is an entrance to Tianji Palace, where the dead must stand on a certain stone on one foot for 3 minutes. A virtuous person will be able to do this, where an evil person will fall and be condemned to hell.
What if you just have no balance?
Yeah.
Then I'm afraid that's it for you, down into the fiery pits.
Standing on one foot in the middle of a room for 3 minutes is quite, like, it's a reasonably difficult feat for the average person, I would say.
Yeah. Even more difficult if you don't technically have a foot to stand on as a ghost.
But I like the idea that they've gone, oh, can't stand on one foot. Clearly a murderer. Yeah. The evidence is absolutely bang to rights.
Also, after you've been through all that helplessness and torture, they just ask you to stand on a foot.
Yeah. It's very much a, I've just got one last thing.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
No, what is it? Just stand on one foot.
Yeah, just stand on one foot.
It really does have a Monty Python and the Knights of the Holy Grail feel to it, doesn't it?
It would, the third test in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, instead of having to take a leap of faith from the lion's mouth, was, Indy, you've got to stand in the middle of this room for 3.5 minutes on one foot. I think the film would have dragged at that point.
I think so, unless there had been sort of a number of Knights Templar just poking him with sticks and tickling him under the armpits.
The penitent man, only the penitent man could stand on one leg.
Yeah. One more thing. This is a bit sad and serious, but I like it for its name, to what it commemorates. In Benin, there's something called La Porte du Non-Retour, which is the Door of No Return. And it is a commemoration of the millions of enslaved Africans who were departed from the town of Ouidah on the coast of Benin. And it's a really impressive monument, and it's an archway, and then it has a number of sculptures on either side, and then a picture sort of depicting what I presume were enslaved men who were loaded on the ships there from the 1580s through to the 1720s. And just the look of this door or arch looking out onto the sea where they were transported is just incredibly powerful. And yeah,
there is one of those in Ghana as well. Ghana has a door of no return as well, in the House of Slaves. Yeah,
yeah,
they're very eerie places for obvious reasons.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine. But having had not heard of them before I did research for this podcast, and I like that is commemorated, and I like the way that it's commemorated. My nomination, to be honest, guys, is equally miserable, but is also, we're far enough detached from it in time that it's also a little bit comedy. So let me take you to Florence and tell you about the Ospedale degli Innocenti, the Hospital of the Innocents. In the 1400s, Florence had a lot of unwanted babies. And very often these would be girls for reasons of patriarchy. Mm-hmm. And so babies would be abandoned hither and thither in the fields, in the alleyways, in pews of churches. Florence was literally, according to this article I'm reading, crawling with abandoned babies. And so...
well, they wouldn't be walking, would they?
No, absolutely not. Many of the foundlings were given to the Silk Guild because it was the richest and most powerful guild, and that guild would, you know, have the means to look after them. And so eventually it was decided that a place needed to be built and established to house these children. And so this hospital was built. It was really an orphanage, but it was called the Ospedale degli Innocenti. Mm. And there needed to be a mechanism for the children to be dropped off. And what they had was essentially a turnstile door, so that the woman who dropped them off could drop off the baby without being seen and without suffering the social opprobrium of doing so. So yeah. Above the door would be a statue of Mary pointing down as if to go, leave your unwanted child here. And the child would be placed on a turnstile that would then spin them round, and they would slide down a chute into, in inverted commas here, so I'm quoting from a text, the basin of abandonment. And on either side of the basin were two terracotta figures of Mary and Joseph, and the basin doubled as a manger, and the child would then be picked up and wet-nursed back to health. So, or, well, wet-nursed into their new life. And listen, I suppose that it's a happy thing, because these children would otherwise be abandoned, would be taught life skills and taught how to read and write, but there's something just a bit sad and also faintly ridiculous about having an unwanted child and putting it on what looks like a tiny football turnstile or an end of the pier ride of, you know, I don't want my baby, stick it on there, pull the lever, crrr, the baby goes down the little slide and out of your life.
I was just going to say, is the chute necessary? Strictly, is it necessary, or is it just a fun feature for whoever catches it at the bottom? Because that seems very unnecessary in the process to me.
I'll be honest, you're right, because in my mind, it's a very Wallace and Gromit addition to the whole process.
Yeah.
I suppose it's like, oh, your mum is abandoning you, but we're at the fair.
Did they have someone at the top going, you know, wait your turn, so to make sure that they were out of the way before the next person could go?
Yeah, I mean, they certainly wouldn't have you must be this old to ride this slide.
Yeah, absolutely. Apparently some women would abandon their children and then get hired as wet nurses by the hospital.
So
that they would then be paid, they'd then be paid for feeding, they'd end up feeding their own child as part of their duties. But
yeah, I like the fact that I've gone like, hey guys, I've got something that's a bit sad, but we can make it lol lol lols. And the response from you two is like, no, this is just very sad, Ben.
That is the nature of this podcast, but it's got slides, so
yeah, exactly. What, like, I mean, if I was going to design a entrance to an orphanage, then I'd be like, yeah, definitely slides. I mean, yeah. You wouldn't want a seesaw. Maybe you could have it as a seesaw where, you know, you put the unwanted orphan on there, and then an orphan who's just found a home is on the other end of the seesaw, and you put your orphan on there, and the other one gets catapulted over the walls. Our suggestions for the world's worst door are Barry's, of one of the most important doors in the United Kingdom, number 10 Downing Street. Shellacker's nomination of the conceptual Norman door, a push-me-pull-you of an apparatus, and mine of the turnstile at the Ospedali degli Innocenti, the playground for the discerning Florentine orphan. Excellently diverse selection of doors, my friends. I think I'm probably going to disqualify mine just because of the deadened reaction I got from the pair of you, because we do like the nominations on this to be reasonably light and fluffy and comedic, and both of you are like, nah, Ben, that's just really sad. So I'm torn between Shellacker's very well argued conceptual problem with the Norman door and Barry's of a door behind which have lived a series of pricks.
Can I make a point, though, is that much of my argument was based on the fact that number 10 Downing Street's door is a Norman door. It's got the sign saying to push, but you can't push it. It's got a letterbox, which doesn't function. It's got a lock, which doesn't function.
Yeah.
And it's numbered... it's numbered incorrectly with a letter instead of a number, and the person who supposedly lives behind it doesn't even live behind it. So yeah.
There's nothing that could make me feel worse for the rest of this month than knowing that that's not a zero and that is an O.
Yeah.
I could encounter many Norman doors, but I will never get this out of my head.
You'll never not see that now.
Oh, well, yeah. So the most famous address in London after 221B Baker Street should really be number 10 Downing Street.
Downing Street, yeah.
Surely what they just need to do is swap the... maybe they need to check and see whether the O in Downing is actually a zero and then just swap them round. All right, it is actually quite pleasing to discover that the world's worst door, which will come as no surprise to 75% of the colonised countries on Earth, is number 10 Downing Street. Before we go, it is time for the best news of the week, which we shall continue pumping out until the end of this goddamned pandemic. And we go to Northern Ireland and a Zoom meeting that took place a number of weeks ago as part of the Northern Irish Assembly, and it involved a local civil servant, a research officer called Mr. Colin Pigeon, and he was on a Zoom call with his colleagues Rachel Keyes and Chris Rothwell when he got disturbed. And the reason he got disturbed is because his cat had recently caught a live bird and brought it into the room while he was discussing public finances in Northern Ireland. And the bird that he'd brought in, that the cat had brought in, was a pigeon.
Yes.
So Mr. Pigeon's cat had caught a pigeon, and that was recorded both on the Zoom call and, I believe, in the political record. And
in the Northern Ireland version of Hansard, presumably there is a sentence where he goes, excuse me, I've got to catch my cat, which has caught a pigeon.
Yeah, precisely. And brilliantly, he has now got a specially made doormat outside his house with a picture of a pigeon, and on it it says, House Pigeon, embrace the chaos.
Very cool.
A good motto for Northern Ireland.
Yes, it very much is. Before we go, my friend, Shalaka, where can our listeners find you and what they find you doing when they get there?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Shalaka Kurup. And if you want to see photos of food that I'm cooking, because I'm that millennial, I'm at Shalaka Kurup on Instagram.
Smashing stuff. Well, we're all off to tell the current incumbent of number 10 Downing Street about the turnstile at the Hospital of Unwanted Children, because we imagine he might want to drop one or two of his brood off there. Until next time, goodbye.